purpose. And I'm going to tell you about that in a moment. First, I wanted to pass around an article just to tell you, so see what's going on in Talmudic studies today. I was taken by the article. It's about a Talmudist, Shama Friedman, Rabbi Shama Friedman. This appeared in Jewish Ideas Daily, and Shama Friedman was both my teacher and my son's teacher. When I was studying Talmud, he was one of the principal students of Professor Saul Lieberman. And already, while I was in rabbinical school, he had made Aliyah. And Shama Friedman is doing some of the basic work in study of in trying to peel back the layers in the Talmud. That is to say, to take a sugya and to imagine what it was like when it originally started. For that he uses models, he uses computer models, language models, and tries as a result of that to construct the way in which the Talmud actually came into being. It's similar to the method of David Weiss HaLivni. HaLivni is doing similar work. Reference is made in the third page here. Much of the work by Friedman and his students is, of course, technical. Significance extends beyond academic confines and has already begun to reshape historical understandings. Thus, Gebhard Rubinstein has shown that Friedman and HaLivni's efforts yield a more coherent picture of the evolution of the great Babylonian yeshivas. So they're trying to use this material to also reconstruct history. I don't know whether all of you know that reference is made here to Jeffrey Rubinstein, who is an excellent Talmudist and is an expert in the Agadah, and he is now teaching here in Or HaZarua on Tuesday nights. He is teaching the introductory class in context. They are now up to the Talmudic period, and Professor Jeffrey Rubinstein at NYU is teaching that piece of the course. It's actually supposed to be taught by someone else. And when I taught my piece in that course probably about a month ago, they had just received word that the person who was supposed to teach it couldn't teach it. And unfortunately, they had a substitute, Professor Jeffrey Rubinstein. I said, oh, yes, sir. Unfortunately, you realize what a gift you just got? You have one of the finest Talmudists really teaching today, who's going to be your teacher. He's teaching you Introduction to the Talmud. So he's teaching here on Tuesday nights in the downstairs in the social hall. I don't know if the seminary will let you sneak in, but you don't have to tell them. So No, this is context is collaborative between the congregations, not only Or HaZarua, but it takes place here, but it is under the auspices and formally it is the Jewish Theological Seminary that runs context now. It used to be called MEA, and that was run by the Hebrew College in Boston. It no longer is associated with Hebrew College. It came under the aegis of the Jewish Theological Seminary and is now called context. So that's one thing. Number two, if you were present at last week's lecture, Professor Schiffman, I mentioned in the course of something, some of the things that he has written. He is the editor of the Encyclopedia of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And I think I mentioned in passing that it was up in our libraries. I just wanted to show you this. It's a two-volume work on the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's with the encyclopedias over here.
Oh, okay.
Kept over here with the encyclopedias. We have we're organized enough so that the encyclopedias are in one place. We're sort of not a high level of organization, a loose level of organization, but the encyclopedias are all over there. And there are a number of wonderful encyclopedias. What happens is that these things come out, scholars get involved in specialized encyclopedias, and when I think it's relevant, I just buy them. I buy them. So you'll see we have the best encyclopedia of Jewish medical ethics is there. If you ever want to look up an issue, the easiest way to look up an issue of medical ethics is in that encyclopedia. This Encyclopedia of the Dead Sea Scrolls, I just checked to see whether it has any listing for either Shechita or Kasher, and it doesn't. So I was kind of disappointed to see that, but maybe if I spend more time looking at it, maybe there is some listing that's relevant to what we're studying. I don't really know. But any of these, just see, this is volume one, just give you some sense of the subjects here. Alexander Genius, Apocalyptic Texts, and this is stuff you heard about last week. Arabia, Provincial Arabia, Archaeological Surveys. This is a survey of the different caves in the Qumran area. Nahal Arugot, similarly, in the Qumran area. Baths and Baptism. Calendars and Mishmarot. This is, we're particularly interested in this, Meira. A lot is just about going to be coming out now on calendars. The book was just written, it's not published yet, by a woman scholar who, we'll see what happens with this book of hers. She wrote what is supposed to be a very thorough book on the history of the Jewish calendar. No, it's not Lior. Her name is, what is her name? Batsheva, maybe? slipped my mind for the moment. But as I said, it's not out yet. It's going to come out, I think, in the next month. She has done a tremendous amount of study. And this is an area which also Shiffman was working in. One of the interests that he has is the origin of the calendar and what we accept as the calendar. So we had dinner, and he said that he really believes that what we understand to be the origin of the calendar is much oversimplified. And he mentioned this, I think, in passing in his lecture, that the calendar, he believes that at a certain point, the calendar was a solar calendar, then it became a lunar calendar, and it moved back between being a lunar and a solar calendar. We've learned that it's always been a solar, always been a lunar calendar. He said that's not true. It's not true. The Jews actually used a solar calendar during part of both the biblical period and the Talmudic period. And
Professor Rachel Elior talks about it in one of her books.
Yes?
Yeah, exactly in the context of the ICN and the Qumran. Yeah, I have it at home.
Very good.
And she talks about the fact that in Jerusalem, in the temple, they had to use this solar, and that was part of the conflict, and that's why that sect opposed.
The Sadducees and the.
But that sect, the Qumran sect, also was lunar calendar. What I recall from the book, so they separated was one of the reasons for the separation.
So that's one type of study that's going on now. So this, we have these, and you're welcome to come in and take a look at them whenever you like. Now, in our last class, we really dealt with a number of central concepts in the laws of Kashrut. We dealt with the subject of kivolo kapolto. As it absorbs, so does it give out. We talked about the subject of heat and the significance of heat in the laws of kashrut. We talked about how you kosher a pot. Remember, if you have a non-kosher pot, and here we read the Gemara in Masechet Avodah Zarah, where the koshering of a pot was described, And we read there that the crucial issue was that you boil water, and you had to get the water up at the rim of the pot. And the way the Gemara described it, it was that the water would spurt up and would affect the rim of the pot. And then we went a little bit further and mentioned that the way we actually do it today, to either put a stone in a pot or put some hot object in order to make the water overflow. But the principle that was working there was, kevol ol kach polto. As it absorbs, so does it give back. The question was a question of taste, of the taste of a food which is understood to be absorbed by a pot, and then that taste stays for a certain amount of time. First, you remember, it was noten ta. Noten ta means that it can give its taste, but for a limited period of time. So that if you cook a piece of meat in a pot, you have a pot roast, okay? You take everything that's in that pot out. You wash the pot. So we're not talking about any physical remnants of anything that are in the pot. It's a clean pot at that point. For the first 24 hours, it's notain tam. It can give forth the taste. After 24 hours, it's notain tam lifgam. It gives forth a taste ineffectively, okay? It's a damaged taste. So that in the laws of kashrut, you always wait 24 hours. You wait 24 hours if you're going to make a change in something, and then you go forth and you use the principle then of usually hag'ala. We used that term last time. Hey, gimel, ayin, lamed, hey, hag'ala, which was boiling. Most things are koshered by boiling. And we had seen this here in the text, in our Talmudic text, that the crucial issue was heat, the application of heat, and as something absorbed with a certain level of heat, it will give out again with that same level of heat. Okay? Any questions? It's a very quick review of what we discussed last time. Now, just to review, I want to read to you, the last thing that there was one more issue, and that was the question of burying something in the ground, burying a knife in the ground. And there we saw that, and we saw this again here in Masechet Avodah Zarah, people are familiar with the idea that you have to bury a knife in the ground. And it's a mystery. Why do you have to do that? We saw what the source of that was. The source of it had nothing to really do with the ground as anything mysterious, but it had to do with the creation of an abrasive surface that was effective in removing things on the outside of the knife. So that the Gemara originally made reference to the use of a rag, a thick rag that was in our Gemara here in Chulin, and then in the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, it said you take the knife and you put it in the ground 10 times. And there, obviously, the reason is because the ground itself is abrasive, and the Gemara also limited that. There was a caveat, and it says it has to be ground that is lo avud. Lo avud. Avud is tilled, not tilled ground. This tilled ground has all the stones removed from it. The whole idea is to put the knife in some abrasive environment, and that was the reason for the ground. Most people have forgotten that and just assume that there's a mysterious thing that goes on when you bury something in the ground, but that's not what it's all about. It's all about this idea of the abrasive surface that can remove things that are on the surface of a knife. Okay? Any questions on that? Okay. Now, I was going to read to you the Shulchan Aruch. We covered the subject of sakin sheshachat ba trefa, a knife which was used to slaughter an animal that turned out to be a trefa. And remember, treifa doesn't mean a non-kosher animal. A treifa means an animal who, once the animal is slaughtered, and the shochet does a bidika, he checks the main organs of the animal, he sees that there is a defect in the animal that would have led to a death of the animal in normally the period of a year. So, in his judgment, this would have been a mortal defect in the animal. That's the treifa. So the problem with the knife is that if you slaughter a kosher slaughter, okay, you do everything properly, the shochet then checks the insides of the animal and sees that the animal's a treifa. The problem that we have now is with the knife that you used, because the knife ends up having slaughtered a treifa. Right? And you didn't know that ahead of time. But you want to now slaughter another animal, and you have to do something with the knife. So that was the context in which we saw that there were a few options. One option was that we had to apply heat to it in order to fix the problem. The other was all we had to do was wash it, afilu bitzonein, even with cold water. Even with cold water. Because the issue was, when you use the knife on the animal, is there enough heat generated by the beit hashechita, the area where the knife is in fact cutting, to cause the knife to absorb? It's all an issue of absorption. Heat is the relevant factor for absorption. And we saw that the Gemara had two different points of view about that. One point of view said that sonein was enough, namely that the beit hashechita didn't cause absorption. And then we saw that the Gemara went back and forth. Some said, well, you could assume that it was really hot and still come out with the same position because there's so much blood that comes out when the animal is slaughtered that it just removes whatever substance would have led to a taste, and it's therefore ineffective. But the bottom line was that there were these two different ways. Okay? Now, I want to read to you the Shulchan Aruch. This is Yoredeah. Now, Yoredeah is that section of the Shulchan Aruch where you find the laws of Kashrut. The most common references made to the Shulchan Aruch are not to Yoredeah. They're to Orachayim. First section of the Shulchan Aruch is Orachayim. Orachayim means the path of life. And that is the daily way of living is in Orachayim. You have a question, for example, I had to look something up in the laws of Tefillin just the other day, and I went to Or HaChaim. I had to look it up in Or HaChaim. There's a section in there that deals with Tefillin. The whole prayer service is an Or HaChaim. The cycle of the Jewish year, the Sabbath, the festivals, all that is in Or HaChaim. Okay? And we have the Shulchan Aruch here. It's right in back of you guys. See those huge, really long volumes? That's it, the really long ones. Pull one out that's on the far right. I don't know that they're in any correct order. Okay, what's it say?
Aleph.
Aleph, oh, it's in the correct order.
From right to left.
That's supposed to be. Okay. Meginerit is a commentary, but that should be the Shulchan Aruch, Or HaChaim. See, the Shulchan Aruch is printed much the same way the Gemara is. The Shulchan Aruch is in the center. Just set it up there so we can take a look. The Shulchan Aruch is in the center, and then there are a variety of commentaries around the outside. See whether you can see. I can't read it from here. What's up the bold lettering at the top of the page?
Hilchot Tefillin.
There you go. So that's Or HaChaim is where you find all those kinds of things. The laws in Yoredeah are the laws that are not connected with the daily regimen or with the festivals, but involve other areas, principally kashrut, but not by any means only kashrut. Laws of mourning, for example, are also in Yoredeah. Okay? So I am reading to you now from the Shulchan Aruch Yoredeah, Siman Yud, that means chapter 10, Seif Gimel, paragraph 3. That's the way it's broken up. Sakin sheshachat batrefa. A knife that has slaughtered an animal that turns out to be a trefa. Asur lishchot ba. You are not allowed to use that knife for shchita. Ad sheyadichena bitzonein. Until you wash it with cold water. So you see, the law is that cold water is enough. Cold water is enough to prepare that knife. O yikachena bidavar kasha, or you rub it with some hard material. The assumption, this is what the way that he's summarizing, is Rabbi Yosef Karo is summarizing what we read about Hebrew we call it a vilon, a curtain, just to use a thick piece of cloth. So that's what, those are your two methods then. Both of those methods were mentioned in our Gemara for cleaning the knife. V'no hagin ata, but the custom is now, he's writing now in 1570, okay, so you're going to read about the technology of 1570. Ve'noagin ata lekancha yafe b'se'ar ha'behema. The way to do it is to clean it well with animal hair. So probably that was the progenitor of our steel wool. You know, well, we have in a far more sophisticated form, we have steel wool. They used animal hairs, and I'm sure that some animal hairs, I don't know, porcupine quills or whatever it is that are more abrasive than other things. So that's what that vishapir dame, he says, and this is a good thing to do. So in other words, he's in favor then of what is in the 16th century modern technology, and that's the way to do it. So whatever is the best way to do it, you know, and I had mentioned to you that in our technology, it seems to me that what we would do is use steel wool in this brillo or something like that, exactly.
But the hair of the animal did not have to come from a kosher
animal. Correct. It probably didn't have to come from a kosher animal because
in your porcupine example.
Yeah, that's not a kosher animal. Well, it couldn't be if that's the animal. I assume that it's
sticking
up the animal.
A kosher animal. That's why you're doing that.
You nip the animal.
It's an animal drain. Get against your knife.
Okay.
And you're
caught. Okay, goes on. It goes on. The im shachap bo below hadacha. If you take that knife that has been used for the trefa shchita, and you do another shchita without having washed it, right? You forget. Yadiach beit hashchita. What you have to do is wash the area that's adjacent to the cut that was made. So that's quite significant. You see that the force of all of this is you don't have to throw it away. And you don't have to cut off. We also read about the possibility of cutting off the area that was in contact with it. So you see that basically they're mekel, they're lenient. The law is lenient in these areas, which is not to say anybody really is lenient today, but the law is lenient. The im ragil lishchot bo trefot tadir. If the particular knife had been customarily used for the slaughtering of many trefot, I mean, if it turns out that this particular knife, you know, you just realize after a while, you do the bidikot not after each slaughtering, but you do 10 slaughterings, and then look and you say, see that, you know, 10 of them were trefas. So then you've reused and reused the same knife, so the likelihood then that you are going to absorb something could be argued is greater. So that there, sarich ni'itza eser pe'amin bakarka kasha. You have to take that knife and stick it 10 times in hard dirt. In hard dirt. Okay? That's just not to raise the stakes. Because you've increased the amount of use on the knife, you raise the stakes, you make sure that you clean it more effectively than simply cold water on it, washing it with cold water. Okay? So that's the law now in the Shulchan Aruch. As I said, I'm not telling you that anybody would abide by that law, because generally the laws of kashrut are observed far more stringently than is required. That's generally the case. Okay? Questions? We're okay. Very good. Now we're in Daf Chet Amud Bet 8b2. This is a slight review of what I just said, but I'm doing this because you need to keep this in mind for the next thing that's going to happen. Sakin trefa, a knife that has been used to cut a trefa, pligi bar Rav Acha v'Ravina. Rav Acha and Ravina disagree about how the knife will be repaired. Chad amar bechamin. One said that you have to purge it in boiling water. The chad amar bitzonen. The other one said it's enough to wash it in cold water. The hilchata afilu bitzonen. And the law is cold water is enough. You don't have to use water. The iika belita de farsa le michpere. And if there is a red made from a curtain with which to wipe it, lo tzarich, you don't even have to wash it because the rag is enough. Okay? That's what we've just said there. Now we go on to the next page, 8b3. Mara then says, Uliaman diamar bechamin. According to the one who said that the knife used to slaughter that trefa has to be made kosher then with boiling water, maitama. What's the reason? Why does it have to be made with a boiling water? Mishum dekab bal'a isura. It seems that it must be because the knife has absorbed something which is prohibited. Right? So if somebody said you have to apply heat to that knife, it must mean that that person assumes that the knife has absorbed something. The way you absorb is through the application of heat. So if you have to apply heat to get rid of it, it must be that they're assuming that there was enough heat for the knife to absorb. So the Gemara then goes on and says, Mishum dekab bal'ai sored deheitera, it says that, deheitera nami bal'a eber minachai. The Gemara raises a weird problem. I say it's weird because it's not illogical, it's just odd. Which occasionally the Gemara will do, and usually in order to clarify things. We have a law which goes back to the story of Noah called Eber Minachai. Eber Minachai. You are not allowed to take any flesh from a living animal. You can't take it from a living animal. You have to slaughter the animal first, then you can make use of the flesh. Okay? You can't do it from a living animal. I may have mentioned to you that we've had congregants who have described this. Terry Corwich told us about when she saw this done in Japan, that they served fish on the table, the live fish, and then they cut off the piece of the live fish and ate it. That was the way they did it, because it's very fresh. There's no doubt about that. Well, that's prohibited by the Torah. So Terry said, before I went to Japan, she said, just be careful of Eber Minachai. It's called Eber Minachai. Eber is a limb from a living animal. Okay? Because the Japanese don't realize, they think that you could be very good, they try to be very accommodating, the Japanese. So you tell them, kosher, you can't eat this, you can't eat that, they'll do everything you want them to do. But you forget certain things, because it never occurs to you that anybody would do that. She said, you've got to be aware of that, that stuff like that can happen, because it's not in their purview. They don't think that there's anything wrong with that. So just think to yourselves here. The Gemara says, if we say that the heat of the Beit HaShechita, the place where the Shechita takes place, is enough for the knife to absorb. And we say that that's true with the Trefa. How about a normal, perfectly normal, okay slaughtering? You know what? We could raise an objection with slaughtering in general. Because as soon as you have cut into the animal, the first cut is made before the animal dies. So at that point, it's Eiver Menachai. So any knife then that does any kind of cutting, in fact, is absorbing. If it's absorbing, then it's absorbing Eiver Menachai. And Eiver Menachai is prohibited. So even the act of Shechita involves a prohibition. How could we do Shechita in the first place? How can we use this knife? Because until the animal is dead, whatever has happened until then is prohibited. And if the knife has absorbed it, the knife absorbs something that's prohibited, we continue the Shechita, and we're shechting the animal with a prohibited knife. That's the kind of stuff only the Gemara would think of. Okay. I never thought of that. Okay. So then the Gemara answers, Ey matbala, when does the knife begin to absorb? Lechi chayma, when it gets hot. Ey matkachayma, when does it get hot? Lechi gamra hashchita, at the end of the shchita, not at the beginning of the shchita. At the beginning of the shchita, the knife has just touched this warm area. It takes the knife a while to warm up. How long? Well, till you get to the rest of the cut, till you've actually killed the animal. By the time you've actually killed the animal is now a kosher animal. Right? It's kosher because it slaughtered it properly. Now the knife is hot enough to absorb. What does it absorb? It absorbs a kosher animal. There's no problem. Okay. Questions? Very good. Okay. So the Gemara dealt with that problem. Okay. We're going on. Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Rav. Rav Yehuda says, in the name of Rav, since we've learned now a variety of issues relating to the knives, Rav Yehuda says in the name of Rav, Hatabach Tzarich Shlosha Sakinim. A butcher needs three knives. A butcher needs three knives. Now keep in mind that in those days, the assumption was also the butcher's Shochet. Okay? The having a separate butcher and a separate shochet was probably not their reality. So he's saying the tabach, the butcher, and the tabach is in the Talmudic Hebrew, will usually mean butcher. We don't say that in modern Hebrew. So he pleads. What do you say?
Tabach is a cook.
The tabach is a cook. That's correct. Mm-hmm. Tabach in the Talmud.
You're talking about katzav.
A katzav. Katzav is a butcher. That's right. Katzav is a butcher, right. Hatabach sarich shlosha sakinim. The butcher needs three different knives. Achat sheshochet ba. He needs one knife just for shechita. And we know why that is, because we saw that having nicks in the shechita knife creates an invalid shechita, creates a trefa. So that's no good. The knife that you use for shechita is very delicate. It's very sharp, and you can't use it for any other purpose. So that we understand. Achat sheshochet ba, that's one thing. Yechad shemechatech ba chalavim. And one, no, I skipped. Oh, sorry. Echad shemechatech ba basar. One that he cuts the meat with. Yechad shemechatech ba chalavim. And the other one where he cuts out the forbidden fats. A word on forbidden fats. Torah, in the book of Leviticus. This is the seventh chapter, Parshat Tzav. Parshat Tzav is the second of the chapters about the sacrificial system. Okay, and it goes like this. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel, saying, Kol chelev shor v'chesed ve'ez lo tochel. Any chelev which is from an ox, a sheep, or a goat, you may not eat. Now the chelev. The problem is, what does chelev mean? Chelev does not mean fat, but there is no way to translate it in English other than fat. That's the only English word that's anywhere close. In old Bibles, there was a way. Do any of you remember the old Bibles? S-U-E-T. Suet. Suet. Right. It was always translated. And for the life of me, I went through rabbinical school. I had no idea what suet was. I couldn't imagine what it was. I learned what chelev was. So then I learned backwards. Today, in this, I'm reading to you the New English Translation of the JPS, the Jewish Publication Society. It says, you shall eat no fat of ox or sheep or goat. Then it has a little footnote. See, I eat hard, coarse fat, parentheses, suet. Okay? So there are areas of hard fat in the animal that are really very hard. They're very hard. I've never really handled this stuff myself. I only read about it in the books about kosher. And apparently this is not the kind of fat we're used to on a piece of meat. This is not fat like that. Rather, it is fat that is just plain hard. It's hard fat.
It's
what?
It's solid.
Solid. It's a solid fat. It's a solid fat.
It's white and solid.
It's not gristle. No, it is not gristle. Gristle is gristle. Right. Gristle is something else. This is like a block of hard substance that is in the animal.
Which are the animals again?
The sheep. The ox, the sheep, or the goat. Now, of course, the ox, the sheep, or the goat pretty much covers the kosher animals. Ox means a cow. The sheep and the goat, those are basically your most, those are your domesticated kosher animals. So, you know, you pretty much covered all of it. Now, keep in mind, the key thing, well, let me go a little further. Fat from animals that died or were torn by beasts may be put to any use, but you may not eat it. Fat from animals that died or were torn by beasts may be put to any use, but you must not eat it. So in other words, let's say you had a traitha animal. Okay? Or any animal, because you can't eat the fats. Truth is, you can use them. What do we mean that you could use them? Well, if you find a use for them, let's say you can make soap out of them. Or let's say you sell them to a Gentile, and you then make profit on it. You're allowed to do all kinds of things, but you may not eat it. You may not eat this animal. If anyone eats the fat of animals from which offerings by fire may be made to the Lord, here's the key thing. It is these parts of the animal that are brought up onto the altar, and they are the sacred parts of the animal. One of the key things put on the altar is this fat. It's the chelev. Therefore, it cannot be, it becomes kodesh, it's a holy thing. It cannot be, something here. Paragraph concludes, you must not consume any blood, either of a bird or an animal. Anyone who eats blood shall be cut off from his kin. So this is the prohibition against eating chelev. Actually, You have a kosher animal. You're not allowed to eat the kibbutz. So what do you have to do? You have to cut it off. Problem is, what happens to your knife? If that's forbidden stuff, and you know how any fat is, that adheres to a surface. So you've used this to cut off the chelet, and then that knife now has forbidden substance on it. You're not allowed to eat that substance, so that's why you need a third knife. You need one knife simply to cut off the chelev that you're not allowed to eat. So we need to have three knives. But the Gemara says, the litachen le'echada. Why can't the butcher prepare just one knife for the kosher meat and the forbidden fat? Lichtof ba basar. Hadar lichtoch b'chalavi. It just depends on the order that you do things. You could have one knife, and you cut the meat first with that knife, and then you cut off the chelev. So that it hasn't been a problem for your cutting of the meat. Of course, the next thing you're going to use it for, you're going to have a problem for it. But at least it sets up this theory. So the Mara then says, Zera shema yachtoch chalavim v'achar kach basar. No, we're not allowed to do this. We have to have three knives. It's a gzera. It's a rabbinic law to make sure, because you may just mix them up. And you may end up doing the fat first before you do the meat. So, we have a gzera. But then the Gemara says, hashtanami michlaflei. But even now that you have the law, and you have these two knives, maybe the butchers will mix them up. How do you know that the butcher won't mix up the two knives? You say that the problem is solved with three knives. Why is the problem solved with three knives? Maybe you'll mix up the two knives. So the Mara then says, Kevan de Abstrichinu Trey. Since we oblige the butcher to have two knives, eat lehekera. The butcher will make a mark on each knife so he doesn't mix them up. That's the obvious answer. I mean, a butcher, if he's got two knives and two different things, I can tell you, in most houses, if you're separating between milk and meat, you don't have knives that look alike. One of the basic issues in setting up a kosher kitchen is to create things that are visually distinguishable. Because otherwise you can never keep things straight. So you buy one set of knives of one brand, another set of knives of another brand, or if you have, you get a present. You get two sets of knives that are the same brand. So we take nail polish. You put nail polish on one set of the knives. So that it's always obvious. Why nail polish? Because it stays. It's just effective. It stays on a handle. So you have to mark everything. So obviously that's what the tabach would do as well.
The female kosher animal has parts in the body that produce milk. Milk is not allowed to eat with flesh, with basar. So we are not talking about the cutting off the part that produce the milk.
Correct.
And that's really non-kosher.
No, nothing is milk until it comes out of the animal.
So the parts that produce milk are not milkish?
They're not. Correct, because they would be trade. Because it would be a mixture of milk and meat, right? Because it's meat.
So what is the job of the menaker?
Menaker is something entirely different. Menaker is not to remove that, but to remove the gidon asher, the forbidden, some of the veins that are forbidden.
Shochatim Baret, they're taking care of the gidon asher and the part that produce milk, so those sherik chalab will not stay.
I told you that the laws of kashrut as practice are always more stringent than they have to be. So I would not be surprised if that's what the Israelis do.
But did they slaughter a female animal? Most of it, if we eat beef,
it's female.
99% is female.
Right. I would assume, probably, yeah. But I don't know that these are what you would call milk animals. They're not dairy animals. They're animals that are bred for their flesh, for their meat. But I assume that they're probably mostly females.
Yeah, because they produce. They want them to produce. It's a business.
Yeah. I can't tell you. I've never...
The male are, unfortunately, the harem, the male offspring, they get sold much earlier. They become like basar egel, very, very young, whereas the females are usually raised a little bit. They have more flesh, and then, or they're
raised. Is that so that
milk.
They can also produce, they can reproduce?
Well, once they start reproducing, they let them reproduce until they don't reproduce anymore, not as well. And then but the male are the very, very young.
Okay.
Can I take a little digression about the burning of the fat on the altar?
Okay.
Because I've always been interested in the statements that are in the Torah about the good smell rising to God. And a couple of things always swirled around in my mind as I would read those portions. One is the notion of God descending as a cloud, and the cloud that's produced when fat is burned on a hot stove or whatever the altar was heated, and I'm not sure exactly how that was done, but I think I remember a little bit about that. But the whole issue of God and cloud and God's presence smell as part of an indicator of either humans trying to bridge the gap between the solid world and the ephemeral world that exists above, and how all of that relates to each other.
It's a little bit of a big question. I would just say it's in this week's Parsha, so maybe I'll be tempted to address that on Shabbat. Realize that there are different kinds of things that are burned also. When God appears in a cloud, in the temple context anyway, he doesn't appear in the cloud from the sacrifices. He appears rather in the cloud from the incense. It's an incense cloud. And that's what's in the Parsha. This Parsha is about incense. And that's the Yom Kippur story, when the Kohen Gadol goes in, takes a fire pan, an incense, and puts the incense on the fire pan, and then suddenly there's a cloud, a puff of smoke. The question is asked by all the commentators, and there is no resolution to this, but I'll tell you what the two sides are. One side is that God appears in the cloud. The other is that the cloud hides God. So they're two different things. One is that God somehow is in the cloud. The other is that the cloud makes sure that you can't see God, who is not in the cloud. There's no resolution to that, but those are the two different points of view that you have there. And the image of the Reach Nichoach, the sweet savor going up, that is used in relation to the altar. As you have said, and the innards of the animal that are burned on the altar. And it's basically an image that you have, and it's a pagan image, I'm sure. It's an image that's been studied a lot, the use of these images in the Bible and in pagan religion. Actually, we think that it's a metaphor in the Bible, because in pagan religion, you have gods who need food. In the Bible, God has no need of food. God doesn't eat. But that process is one of nonetheless relating to God. So it's not exactly clear how it works, but it's effective. When that I don't have... On one foot, I don't know what I can say. Okay? Okay, we go on. Okay, now we're down to the bottom of the page, 8b3. Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Rav. This is more Rav Yehuda's Amar Rav. Hatabach tzarich shnei kelim shel mayim. A butcher needs two vessels of water. Echad shemadiach po basar, echad shemadiach po chalavim. One in which he washes his meat, and the other one in which he washes the forbidden chelev. Vinitake lechada. Why not have him have just one washing vessel? Vinidach nadiach po basar, hadar nadiach po chalavim. And we would do the meat first, and then do the fat. Exactly the same as the last thing we saw about the knives. So here it's used as far as the washing vessels. Gzera shema yadiach chalavim yachar kach basar. This is a gzera of the rabbis, lest a person switch them around and do the chela first, followed by the meat. But even now that we have two basins, you can mix them up. You can mix them up. Since we require him to have two of them, the butcher will make some mark on them so he'll be able to tell the difference. Okay? Now, the Gemara goes on. Amar HaMemar Mishmed Rav Papa. Maybe it says in the name of Rav Papa. Lo Lischof Inesh Kafe Ilave Bisra. Person should not invert, here it's the flex. What that means is, you have a piece of meat, and you have chelev on that meat. We say you're going to have to cut the chelev off the meat, right? But at a certain point, before you cut it off, you may have a piece of meat with chelev on it. Okay? So if that's the case, where is it? A person should not invert the flanks with the attached forbidden fat upon other meat. Okay? So let's say you have one steak here. You then have the forbidden fat on top of that, and then the okay fat on top of that. So you're now touching fat onto what was just a plain piece of meat. Of course, you couldn't help the one that it came off of, because that's how it started there. Lo lishof inish, person should not invert the flanks. Didaiv tarba uvala bisra, because the fat grips and the meat absorbs it. If you leave it for any length of time, it simply can liquefy some of it, not a lot of it. See, but you don't need a lot in order to make it a prohibited substance. Ihache, if it is so that the flat placed upon the meat drips on it, ki teritze nami. And even when the flanks and attached fats are placed straight on the butcher's block without any other meat below, how about just the plain, you have meat, and you have attached chelev to it. If you're going to say that the chelev drips, well, it drips through into the meat. So, even if that's a general problem, that's a problem for any piece of meat. Right? Daiv tarba uvala bisra. We're worried that the fat will melt and the meat will absorb it. Gemara then answers, karma mafsik mitatai. A membrane separates the fat from the meat below it. And in fact, it's not just fat and meat. There's a membrane that joins the two of them together. That membrane is enough to stop one from going into the other. Whereas if you have just a cut piece of chelev, and that then is in contact with another piece of meat, then indeed you have a potential problem. Okay? But you don't have it in a normal piece of meat that has the chelev attached to it. So the Gemara goes on and says, Iache, if that's true, Ma'alya Nami Karma Ika. There's also a membrane above. Who knows whether there really is a membrane above. Aide de Mamashva Yada de Tabcha Mipatach. since the hand of the butcher rubs against the membrane, even if there is a slight membrane, something that separates between these things, if there is, that just pushing it could cause a problem beyond the membrane. Okay, let's go on. The Amarav Yudha Amarav. Now, we've been reading teachings of Rav Yehuda Amarav. And you know how the Gemara is. Sometimes it just goes on like that. We have more teachings in that form of Amarav Yehuda Amarav. Okay. Amarav Yehuda Amarav. Talmid Chacham Tzarich Sheyilmod Shlosha Dvarim. Ketav, Shchita, Umila. A Talmid Chacham has to learn three things. Ketav. Now, it's not clear what Ketav means. Rashi says Ketav means you have to be able to write documents. And you have to be able to read documents. Well, to emphasize reading seems to me to be silly, because of course the assumption here is that everybody reads. Rabbinic Judaism says, Vishinantam levanecha, you shall teach them to your children. So everybody's got to read. I think that ketav may mean the ability to write sacred documents, to write a mezuzah or tefillin, to be a sofer stam, exactly. Torah, mezuzot, and tefillin. So that's the first of them, it seems to me. Second one is shchita. And the third one is mila, circumcision. So these are the three basics of the rabbinic trade, according to Rav. Every rabbi has to be able to do those three things. God help us if every rabbi were expected to do those three things. Many rabbis, certainly rabbis, European rabbis, a generation, two generations ago, would become expert, certainly in Shechita. Some of the books of our library here are from the library of Sherry's father. You remember Sherry Zurif? What's her father's name? Rabbi Jacobson. Rabbi Jacobson was the Orthodox rabbi in Savannah, Georgia. And when he came to America, he's German born. He died just a few months ago. I think he paid a shibboleth call to him. Got to Sherry, I live on the west side, '70s, and Rabbi Jacobson, when he came to America, he couldn't get a job. So what a rabbi did who came to America, he became a shochet. Because that was part of the training, the standard rabbinic training in many European Jewish communities. The rabbis learned shchita. It was very important. It's rare that that's the case today, at least in this country, and probably also in Israel. It's probably not very common. People go into it as a specialty, but it's not the common thing. And in fact, you have people like the shochet we had here, who is not a rabbi, but people who learn shchita. Same thing is true of mila. Most of the mo'alim are not rabbis. Some of them are, but many of them are not. The mo'alim that we have around here, for example, a number of them are cantors, and they have two professions, one to be cantor, some are Hebrew teachers, some are doctors. We have doctors who are mo'alim. But here, the view of Rab is these three things. Rav Hananya bar Shalmaya Mishmei de Rab Amar. Now again, we have a different transmission of the teaching of Rav. This one from Rav Hananya bar Shalmaya. He says the following: Af kesher shel tefillin ubirchat birkat chatanim v'tzitzit. A rabbi, a chacham, must also be able to tie the knots of tefillin. Tie the knots of tefillin. Uberkat chatanim, you have to know how to officiate at weddings. You have to know the blessings to say. Bit tzitzit, and you have to know how to tie tzitzit. To this day, these are issues in rabbinic practice. Tying the knots in the tefillin refers to two knots. One, the knot in the tefillah shel rosh, that's in the back, and that's in the form, depends on the tefillin that you have. Most of the tefillin that people have in this neighborhood, it looks like a box. Like there are four sections of a box, four little boxes, and it's all tied into one box. My tefillin are not like that. I have Israeli tefillin, they're not tied like that. Israeli Talmud, tefillin, Ashkenazi tefillin from Israel, are tied so that the knot looks like this. It looks like a dalet. It looks like a dalet. That's the way they tie them in Israel. Unless they know they're tying them just for an American audience, because the Americans want them in a, you know, it's like a box, like that.
Square knot.
Well, sort of like that. It's not really a square knot, but looks square. Looks square. So that's the one knot. The other knot is the tefillah shel yad. And we have issues. I frequently will have to take apart a pair of tefillin because they're tied wrong. And it helps to know how to tie the knots. Some are somewhat complicated. There are standard things that are not that complicated, which, if you've been a Boy Scout, you can figure out. I went into Jerusalem once into a tefillin store. I had a lady teach me how to do it. A lady. She says it's very easy. So she taught me how to tie tefillin knots. It was very helpful. It's very useful to know that. And the tying of tzitzit. I just got finished. I just made myself another talit. I wear for the first time this Shabbat. I bought talit. Last time I was in Israel, in December, and I bought tzitzit separate from the talit, so I could tie myself. And I buy tzitzit, if you notice, my tzitzit have the tchelet, they have the blue thread. I buy from an organization called Petil Tchelet. Petil Tchelet is located in Efrat. These are a group of guys that have perfected the traditional tchelet. The only problem with it is it's very expensive. That's why I buy it in parts and I make it myself. It's cheaper if you buy the separate ingredients and you put it together. If you depend upon them to tie it for you, it costs much more. So if any of you want to buy these things, I'd be happy to tie your tzitzit for you. But these are just skills. These are basic skills of Chachamim. So here you see two somewhat different traditions of Rav. And the Gemara picks up on that. The Idach, namely, the first one, why did the first guy leave out these last three? Right? If both of them are bringing traditions of Rav, why did the first guy not mention what the second guy mentions? The second guy mentions Af, in addition. So, alright, so that one we don't have to question, because he accepts what the first guy said. But the first guy apparently doesn't accept what the second guy said. Well, let's see what the Gemara says. See how the Gemara solves it. You see, the Gemara is not so far from what you just said. Hane shechicha. These skills are common, so that any Torah scholar will know them without devoting time to learn them. Okay? You didn't have to say them. They're easy things. They're easy things. The other guy, Thelma, you have to add them too. The Amar Rabbi Yehuda Amar Shmuel. Now we're in a slightly different tradition of transmission. This is Rabbi Yehuda said in the name of Shmuel. Kol tabach she'ena yodea hilchot shchita, asur le'achol mishchitato. Any butcher who doesn't know the laws of shchita, you can't eat from his shchita. Because there are butchers who know and there are butchers who don't know. Even in those days, obviously, there were some who were expert in shita and some who just could cut meat but couldn't slaughter meat. The issue is whether you know the laws. Whether you know the laws. To cut up a piece of meat, you have to know what the consumer wants. To be able to slaughter, you have to know what God wants. Okay? That's the difference. The Elu Hein Hilchot Shkita. Now, this is what's important here. Again, Kol Tambach She'eino Yodei Hilchot Shkita Asu Le'echol Mishkitato. Any butcher who does not know the laws of slaughtering, it is forbidden to eat from his shechita. The Elohim, what are the laws of slaughtering? What are we talking about? Here they're listed. Shehiya, and these are the key terms that you must remember. Shehiya is when you move the knife through the cut that you do not stop while moving. Has to be a continuous movement. Dirasa. Dirasa is pressing. Pressing.
Like back and forth.
No. Scary? No.
Back and forth.
No. Dirasa is where you take the knife and instead of moving it like that, you push it in. You push it in. Chalada is burrowing. That's where you take the knife and you stick it between the trachea and the esophagus instead of cutting through all the way. And, let's see, hagrama is cutting beyond the designated area. There is one area that you have to cut in. Hagrama is either to one side or the other side. And the final one is ikur, is tearing. Ikor, for all practical purposes, means that you're cutting with a knife that has a nick in it. Okay? So those are the bases of the law of Shechita. I'll say them again. Shehiya, tarrying, dirasa, pressing, chalada, burrowing, hagrama, cutting outside the Beit HaShechita, and ikor, which is tearing. Any questions about those? We've mentioned them before. Here they're all in a compact, in a beretta. My kamashmalan. So what is Shmuel teaching us? Kulhu teminhu. We didn't need Shmuel's comment just that we just read about any tabach who doesn't know the laws of shechita, you can't eat a shechita. Who would have ever thought you could? We know, you just told us the laws of Shechita. So we know that these are the laws of Shechita. We know the Mishnah about the laws of Shechita. So what do you need to tell us this for? Of course it's true. Doesn't make any difference whether he's a tabach or anybody else. So the Gemara says, Lo tzricha. No, we do need this teaching. Why? Sheshachat lepanenu bet o gimel talmim. Because it could be that this guy slaughtered properly before us two or three times. Okay? This tabach, he watched a lot of shochtim. So he watched what they were doing. And he's able to mimic them. He can do that. The shachat shatir. And his shechita looks good. It looks okay. Mahu detema mide'ibel shachat shatir. You might have said that since we see a case like this where somebody can do two or three and they can turn out to be good, that we might learn from this that anything that he slaughters is good. Therefore, Shmuel comes to teach us that you have to know something about the laws of Shechita. That's the key thing. It's not enough to just be able to imitate what a shochet does. And it could be that you'll do it right. In order to be a shochet, in order to have your shechita, proper shechita, you have to know what you're doing, and then you have to do it right. So it's not enough just to be able to do it right. You have to know, and you have to do it right. Of course, not enough to just know. You also have to do it right. So that's the force of his teaching. That's the Kamash Malan. That's the additional teaching that you learn from it. Okay? Yes. No.
Going on just a little bit, it looks like they're talking about the necessity of supervision as well. So would it be that Shmuel is teaching that in order to emphasize that you still have to have supervision regardless of how skilled this person is?
I don't think in this context, no. I think in this context, what the Gemara is emphasizing is the knowledge, that you have that knowledge. And we'll see, maybe it'll bring up supervision, but I'm not...
No, I saw it in the, I guess it's the last line of 9A1? Right.
Okay, when the Logamar, Zinim Deshahe Vedaris Veloyada. That's not supervision.
The English translation.
Oh, the English translation. Oh, that is. That's not in the text. I think the force of the text here is Kamash Malan Kevan the Lo Gamar. Since this Shochet has not learned the laws of Shechita, Zimnin Deshahe V'Daris V'Lo Yada. There are times that he will Shahe, namely he'll stop the knife, he'll pause, vidaris, or he'll press into it, velo yada, and he didn't know what he was doing. He didn't know that he was doing anything wrong. The reason that the English adds that without supervision is that nobody would have known. Nobody would know. If you have supervision, then somebody will immediately pick it up. But if there's no supervision, nobody would know that there's anything wrong. You assume this guy knows what he's doing, because in fact he does have a little bit of a track record. Okay? But we can't, that's not enough. He has to know what he's doing. Yes?
Brother, it's so interesting, but I think it's just that he has to have knowledge. That suggests that the absence of Shochet might have to be deliberative.
Mm-hmm.
It came up earlier about whether a machine could have seen it or not. So one might infer that either there has to be knowledge that it couldn't be done by a machine, yeah. But if there's deliberation implied, that if you can't just accidentally do it correctly, then that would have implications, I think, for the significance of it and also for who could do it.
I would say that's true. That's true. It's a nice way to put it, that having knowledge is tantamount to being able to be part of a deliberative process. That's a human thing. It's peculiarly a human thing. And that's one of the reasons you need a shochet as opposed to an automatic system that does it. That's nice. Okay. We talked earlier on about the need for the shochet to be tzadik and so on. That's all connected, I would think. It's a nice way to connect. Okay, good. Keep going. All right, we have another Rabbi Yehuda Amar Rav relating to Shechita. Amar Rabbi Yehuda Amar Shmuel. Amar Rabbi Yehuda Amar Shmuel. Rabbi Yehuda says in the name of Shmuel, Atabach Tzarich Sheyivdok Basimanim Liachar Shechita. The butcher. Now here, this is, it really means, I think, the Shochet. Must inspect the pipes, the trachea and the esophagus, after Shechita. Right? He has to inspect them to see that they were cut properly. Amar Rav Yosef, Rav Yosef said, Af anan namitanina. We have also learned this in the Mishnah. Rabbi Shimon Amer, in shaha kedei bikur, if a slaughterer paused long enough for an inspection, he has invalidated the slaughter. Right? If you wait, and if you wait long enough to check, then you invalidate the slaughter. Well, what that is implying is that you have to check. Okay? That's why this is brought up at this point. an inference is made from this, but you have to check in the first place. My love, kidei bikur simanim. Doesn't this mean that he has to pause long enough to inspect the pipes? Must mean that. Well, that's what the Gemara is assuming. And the Gemara then rejects this. Amar le Abaye, lo. Hachi amar Rabbi Yochanan. This is what Rabbi Yochanan said. Kedei bikur chacham. It must last long enough for the local scholar's inspection of the knife. We're not saying, this is the interpretation of the Mishnah that talks about shehiya, pausing long enough. How long do you have to pause? How long do you have to pause? Is if it's pausing to check the innards of the animal, that's a long time. That's not a normal pause. That takes a long time. You have to open up the animal, to look inside. That takes a long time. So the Gemara is saying, no, when it's talking about the amount of time for the pausing, it's kedei bikur chacham. There's another kind of check that has to go on after each slaughter, and that's checking by the shochet of his knife. So that's what we're talking about here. That's instantaneous, because all he has to do is look at his knife. He cleans off the knife, and then he looks at it, and he can see the shochet has a fine eye, or he checks it with his finger, and he knows whether his knife is okay. So it's not a long time, it's a short time. All that is simply to define the shahiya, the amount of time we're talking about of pausing. Okay? Good? Maybe kochacham. Im kein, if that's so, natata bevarecha l'shiurim. Oh, it says, if you're concerned about checking a knife, well, maybe somebody else has to check the knife. If somebody else has to check the knife, if we say a chacham has to check the knife, it could mean you have to take the knife to the local rabbi. If the local rabbi is located right next to you, he's standing in the line, you're doing the shechita, and his job is to check the knife, then it doesn't take any time. But in rabbinic law, you can't say, well, he has to take it to a rabbi, and use that as a sign of how much time, because we don't know where the rabbi is. If the rabbi is far away, it's one amount of time. If the rabbi is near, it's another amount of time. So it's not clear what he's talking about. So then the Gemara answers, Ela kadei bikur tabach chacham. No, we're talking about the shochet who is there, then and there, looking at his knife, so that it's something that happens right then and there. Okay? We're not really separating anything out. It's not a long time, and it's not a time that's sort of open to judgment. It's a, what we're saying is a very short amount of time.
So what's the analogy to what we studied last year about the mitzvah? And remember, you have those short windows or longer windows to verify price.
Last year.
Time span. So you can complain that.
Correct.
Correct? That was last year.
Correct. That's correct. There, we did have a window, but we had a problem. We had to limit that window.
Right.
We had to limit that. That's right. It's a similar idea.
Because
the law doesn't like to give too much leniency when dealing with measures. Mm-hmm. Whenever it enters into an area of measures, it wants it to be as clear and as universally understood as possible.
People can follow.
Otherwise, you don't know what you're talking about. You don't know what you're talking about. So that is the effort made here. Okay, any questions?
Can you just go back to what the rabbi was supposed to know? Because they don't mention the ketubah.
Correct.
Was the ketubah after this?
Well, they mentioned, it's contemporaneous.
Writing, but we assume that the ketubah is in the writing?
It could be that the writing refers to the ketubah. You have to know how to write documents of which the ketubah is such a document. So it could be that it's referring to that, yeah.
Those are the laws of the marriage, too.
Yeah, they had Birkat Chatanim. That's specifically blessings of the marriage. That's probably the things you would say under the chuppah.
Right.
But I think both those things are really covered by by the language.
At this time, they were already writing ketubot.
Oh, yes. Oh, ketubot were written. We have the Talmud describes ketubot in great detail already from about 200 BCE. So the Mishnah is 200 C, so the 400 years before the Mishnah, we already have ketubot, and we know their contents. It's all in the Talmud.
I was just going to say, you know, the practicality, though, of the shelchet with examining the plate, it seemed to me, listening to, you know, or visiting shelchet, you don't just do one and then go and have it inspected. This is something that is, you know, many animals in one setting. So if you have to go and have someone else inspect it,
it'll never work.
So it's just very practical.
Correct.
It's
impractical.
Volume that you have to do.
Correct.
But also that's kind of part of the skill when he talks about examining his blade and knowing whether there's a little ruptured meat and things like that. So it becomes part of, I mean, I also think it would probably be expensive to pay for another person's time. It's expensive enough
he really trains two things. He learns how to be a shohet and he learns how to be the scholar who can oversee the process.
Does chickens mass, you know, in a large volume setting? Let's say you have a small village and you have a cow, you know, once a week or once a month.
Right.
That would be a very different scenario where you might just have one person who does, kills it and then hooks. So I imagine it would do a ton of circumstances.
Or they would do their own, you know, for the family. They would do one.
Yes, exactly.
It's like spell check. It's the discipline of spell check.
You mean that you have to do the check?
You have to stop. You have to look.
Correct.
I only try to bring it to a contemporary analogy, because we do many times stop and check.
No, that's
true.
We just
don't appreciate how often we've built
that's
it
correct.
Into our routine.
That's correct. No, absolutely. Fine. To be continued.
Thank you.
More than a quick question. I can't find that nice email for the Shochet.